you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
A good Saturday to you. This is the weekend edition of the LA Report. I'm Julia Paskin, and coming up in just a few minutes, when you think of LA, you might not think of foraging wild food, but in fact, there's lots of it. This week on How to LA, naturalist and author Jesse Starwood took us on a hike to find all the ingredients needed to serve up one very popular LA staple. We'll get cooking in just a few minutes, but first, here's the news. Former Long Beach Police Chief Robert Luna takes the oath of office as L.A. County's new sheriff today, KPCC's Frank Stoltz reports.
Luna soundly defeated Sheriff Alex Villanueva in last month's election. In a news conference after his victory, Luna pledged to be less combative than Villanueva, who, when he wasn't attacking the Board of Supervisors, Civilian Oversight Commission, and reform advocates, he was mocking them.
Public safety is about public trust, and in order to rebuild a lot of these relationships, we have to show as an organization that we're willing to work with people, we're willing to listen to people.
Luna spent 36 years with the Long Beach PD, his last seven as chief. He takes over a sheriff's department that is 10 times his old department size and operates one of the largest jail systems in the country. It is also a troubled agency. Among other challenges, it's facing a state attorney general's investigation over allegations of a pattern of civil rights violations, including excessive use of force. I'm Frank Stoltz.
And staying with incoming L.A. leaders, West Hollywood Mayor Lindsay Horvath narrowly defeated former state senator Bob Hertzberg in the L.A. County's 3rd District race. Horvath tells KPCC she shares her predecessor's priorities, but has her own perspective.
Coming in as a millennial, as a renter, with a little bit different life experience, I think that's also important on this board. And so thinking about some of those 21st century problems that we're facing.
Horvath will be sworn in Monday. Orange County has joined L.A. in the medium level of COVID community transmission, and L.A. could enter high transmission this coming week. If you do get sick with COVID or any other respiratory infection, that means a trip to the local drugstore. But there's a nationwide shortage of amoxicillin, and as KPCC's Mariana Dale reports, some over-the-counter medicines are also missing from local pharmacies.
Last week, Claudia Rivas's kids got sick. Her son had the respiratory virus RSV. Her daughter had an ear infection. Her son's medicine was available right away, but finding amoxicillin for her daughter took days. Riva says the shelves at her Southgate pharmacy were empty.
There's no Tylenol, there's no Motrin, there's no Advil, there's nothing.
Anu Seshadri is a Century City pediatrician and says the shortage of over-the-counter drugs is particularly concerning.
Amoxicillin, there's always other antibiotics that you can use, but it's very hard to find a substitute or a fever reducer other than Tylenol and Motrin.
Mom Claudia Rivas ended up driving 10 miles to find the medicine her family needed. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
And a chance of rain this weekend. Here's Rich Thompson, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service.
Unfortunately, we're not expecting a lot of rain across Los Angeles County. Looks like the bulk of it will remain north of the area. So most areas in LA County will probably see anywhere from maybe a tenth to a quarter inch of rainfall through Sunday night, Monday morning.
There's a new play about Boyle Heights playing at Casa 0101. Remembering Boyle Heights Part 2 is the second half of a show that tells the story of monumental events in the neighborhood from the 1940s to present day. Josefina Lopez, known for Real Women Have Curbs, co-wrote the play.
Boyle Heights is the microcosm of the immigrant experience, and it tells an incredible history. And if we get beyond the surface of like, oh, what a violent neighborhood, and we really see that it's an under-resourced community, but it's incredibly resilient and creative. I want people to go, wow, I didn't know Boyle Heights was so amazing and that with so little, you can do so much.
The show is on for the next 3 weekends. Tomorrow's show is followed by a special Q&A. Tickets are at casa0101.org. And in other artistic news, a new mural being painted at the Thousand Oaks Elementary School features LA's famous P-22 mountain lion. The piece is part of the continued partnership between muralist Jonathan Martinez and the Save LA Cougars campaign to connect the community to P-22 and other LA wildlife. Beth Pratt is the California Regional Executive Director for the National Wildlife Federation.
part of our Save LA Cougars campaign is the education and the connections and getting people inspired to not just love, but want to protect their local wildlife. And Jonathan Martinez's art really does that.
It's going to be painted with the help of the students at Ladera Stars Academy, and the mural will show P22 amid a nightscape of stars alongside other wildlife. We are about halfway through the World Cup. The U.S. is playing the Netherlands as we speak. The current score is 1-0, Netherlands. Yes, the international tournament is about the sport of soccer, but it is also a huge cultural event bringing nations together in a really unique international exchange. So for a look at the matches and their meanings, we're joined by USC sociology and journalism professor Ben Carrington. Ben, welcome to KPCC's Weekend Edition.
Hi, Julia. Good morning.
So the World Cup is kind of like the Olympics in that it allows nations to compete supposedly outside of politics and other global pressures. And right before the opening match, FIFA officials urge teams to, quote, let football take center stage. Is that how it really works? Or are there other themes at play when these games are going on?
Oh, it's one of the great myths of sport that it's somehow removed from politics. The World Cup, the Olympics, in fact, all mega sports events have always been interspersed, intermixed with the politics of the time. So sports likes to claim that it is somehow outside of politics. But any look at the historical record shows that's really kind of far from being the truth. And so in many ways, this current World Cup is actually a continuation. You know, it's the norm rather than the exception to the complex intermingling of sports and politics.
We've also seen some rather ugly behavior on behalf of fans participating. I'm really thinking about just explicit racism that comes out sometimes in matches. Can you tell me about how this venue can be another outlet for that discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sports in general, and football in particular, is important to understand and to analyze because it's a very public arena in which some of the maybe hidden, subterranean, beneath the surface issues within a society come to the fore. And so sports and football is at the same time a space where everybody comes together, everybody plays on an equal footing, and yet at the same time, football is rife with sexism and homophobia and racism. Black players in Europe, in various countries, are quite regularly subjected to racial abuse. Black players will be celebrated and cheered and treated as heroes. And the next minute, if they do something wrong or if the wrong black player scores for the wrong team, they'll be subjected to the most horrendous forms of racism. Now, does football produce that racism? No, that racism was always there. But football and sports provides a venue, a very public venue, if you like, for the articulation of sentiments that lie just beneath the surface.
It is interesting, too, because, you know, you have people of mixed heritage or who feel a connection to multiple places. And so, you know, I'm imagining in the U.S., right, someone's grandparents are from Poland or Ghana, and then those teams are playing against the U.S. in the country that, you know, we were raised in, and those teams play each other. Who do you root for, or does it just kind of make it a more exciting experience to watch the game?
It makes it much more interesting. You know, you're quite right to point out, you know, there's lots of, we see the diasporic roots and kind of connections of many of the teams. You know, modern day France, modern day Holland, and modern day England is a multicultural, multiracial society, in large part due to, you know, these being European colonial powers. And I think what's interesting is that you see, you know, the sons, the grandsons, and the great-great-grandsons of those former migrants now representing those kind of home Western nations. And I think it does produce, I think, a different sense of what it means to be English or French or Dutch when the symbolism of the national team isn't just 11 white players. And of course, sometimes these countries end up playing against, you know, the countries they formerly colonized, you know, France versus Tunisia. You know, there are many examples where you suddenly see the extra symbolic importance that sports carries when you have these kind of former colonies and colonized coming together, clashing on the football field.
In LA, we're a pretty soccer-friendly town, but the U.S. in general, nowhere near as invested as other countries are in the sport. You know, we're watching the game live and people are literally sobbing in the stands during the game. So why do you think it brings so much emotion from some people, and how do we kind of bring that into American culture a little bit more?
Yeah, and I think it's a good point. I mean, I've been in America now for 18 years, and as the listeners may have guessed from my accent, I'm not local to Los Angeles. I'm from the UK, and I can honestly say that the most engaged, active, and exciting fan experience I've had in Los Angeles is going to see the LAFC team play. That the fans are really engaged, and sometimes it doesn't quite, you know, figure on the radar of the mainstream sports kind of entertainment industries. But I actually think there's a really robust soccer culture that already exists here in the US.
That's USC sociology professor and author Ben Carrington. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a delight to speak with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We'll be back after this short break.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Welcome back to the LA Report. I'm Julia Paskin. So you might not think of Southern California when you think of foraging for wild food, but believe it or not, there's been a pretty long history of doing just that in and around LA. These foods have been used for everything, like staples for indigenous communities, delicacies for high-end chefs, and of course, meals for our city's many critters. This week on How to LA, naturalist and author Jesse Starwood took host Brian De Los Santos on a foraging hike where he tried his hand at mushroom hunting, acorn gathering, and berry plucking. And in the spirit of LA cuisine, they prepared some truly unique tacos.
We're in the Santa Monica Mountains right now, in one of my secret spots.
This is Jess.
Jess Starwood. We're gonna see if our recent rains prompted anything to pop up.
Jess is a professional forager here in Los Angeles.
Mushroom hunters are extremely protective of their spots. You get to know how well you stand with your friends by how many spots they share with you.
She's taking us deep into the Santa Monica Mountains to some of her secret spots.
Oh, what is this?
Those are nightshade berries, and they are edible.
Wow, that tastes so good.
Good.
You might be surprised by how much of our native environment is edible.
People don't think of Southern California as a place of abundant wild food. You know, it's dry, it's a desert, we haven't had rain in 9 months.
But if you're like Jess and you know where to look, there's something nutritious to eat around every corner.
Prickly pear, oak trees, all the different sages, elderberries.
I'm Brian De Los Santos, and this is How to LA. Today, we're going foraging.
Ow, ow, ow. Am I gonna bleed?
No.
Oh, it's just the stinging, that's it.
And Jess is gonna cook us up something special with what we find.
Forest to table, forest to pork.
Need a taco?
Yeah, something like that.
Alrighty, y'all. Quick disclaimer. Some of the things we're eating today have deadly lookalikes. Jess is an expert. Don't go eating wild food unless you know exactly what you're doing.
We're on a trail. It's green, luscious mountains everywhere. Some dry grass around us, but we're about to hike for some food.
Right now we're walking past all this wild mustard that it looks dead, looks like a bunch of sticks, but you know the whole plant is edible. At some point during its life.
Evan has a track record that he schedules outings that have inclines or hikes after my leg days. And I'm over here on this incline that's like really hitting a stride here.
We're not gonna tell you exactly where we're hiking and gathering today. And it's not just so Jess can save it all for herself. In the foraging community, sustainability is the name of the game.
Yeah, you know, anytime we're taking something from the environment, we're having an impact. A little different than going to the store. You can't just take whatever you want. The animals and other creatures depend on all of these foods as well. It's not just us.
The practice of gathering and eating wild foods has been a part of life in this area for thousands of years. Today, Jess is looking for ingredients to make us some very special wild food tacos. Acorns to make the tortilla flour, mushrooms for the filling.
A little path through here. Yeah, it's changed a bit since I was here last.
Jess is taking us to a few places along this creek. It's wet, the rocks are everywhere, you don't really know where you're going to step. But Jess says that there might be oyster mushrooms growing on these willow trees.
Oyster mushrooms are going to be maybe 10 days or so after a good heavy rain. We should be just about in that window right now. Fingers crossed, but never any promises.
Can we talk about just foraging for a second? On the drive here, I was telling my friend about coming to record this. My friend was like, yeah, remember when I went to your house and I got those lemons? And I'm like, oh yeah, I never used that. And she's like, yeah, and I also have my maps where like I have trees where, you know, avocados or oranges, whatever, spill over and I'm able to grab those things. I remember when I was a kid, in the apartment building we had, there was a fig tree. And every so often, my mom's like, go run outside and go eat some figs. Like, leave me alone, you know? And I'm like, okay, I didn't know that that was a form of foraging.
Yeah, you know, foraging, at least for me, it's more of a mindset. There's a lot of bad connotations on foraging. Is, you know, you're just pillaging the land and whatever you can find. But it's actually more a mindset of putting to use what is available, especially with urban foraging. You know, I find it so silly that in Southern California, we buy lemons and citrus at the store when everybody seems to have some sort of citrus in their neighborhood already growing. It's just this different mindset of, you know, food comes from the store instead of the actual land around us. This is mugwort. More medicinal than edible. It's extremely bitter. It was actually used for beer back in the day before they used hops.
Jess is filled with all kinds of facts and tidbits like this.
There's a whole bunch of watercress right there and nettle as well. Those are all edible plants.
I've actually been hiking in this area before, but I didn't really realize there were edible things growing for free, like right here on the ground.
Yeah, but there's nothing ever free in life, right? You know, we had to walk here. We had to, the effort it takes to find and process and time and energy we're expending to collect it, which is more valuable, your money or your time.
Okay, you're giving me a morning ritual here to like think about my and reflect on this. I love it.
We're getting deep in the woods now, down into oyster mushroom habitat. Now's the time to start looking. The ones we're looking for are going to be white or gray colored.
There's so much growing in this riverbed. Especially for LA, it's so green. But so far, no mushrooms.
Yeah, like this tree, I know there used to always be one here. All right. So this is mushroom hunting in Southern California.
I love it. It's not always perfect.
No, it's not.
Sorry, y'all. We tried. But don't worry. Jess has a plan B.
Oh, he's got to have a backup plan because, you know, it's not like going to the store expecting your favorite brand to be on the shelf. It's more like working with what you've got. So today there was no fresh mushrooms to collect. Backup plan is we're going to have some nettle with our acorn tortillas.
Jess has taken us all the way to the other side of this big mountain, down into a gully where there's some nettle growing in the stream.
I think this trail links up.
That's stinging nettle, by the way.
There aren't too many spines on the edges of the leaves, so I'm going to grab them like that.
Jess is playing it cool, but let me tell you, that shit hurts.
Basically, they inject formic acid into your skin. It's the same chemical that ants use when they bite you.
Oh.
It will sting for a couple days.
Okay, last thing we need is some acorns. We're not going to be eating the ones we gathered here today. They need a lot of processing before they're ready to eat. But we want to help Jess gather her next batch since she's going to hook us up with some grub later.
This time of year, I can't pass up good acorns when I see them. These are nice big ones, so.
We're in this like squirrel mode, trying to get the biggest ones so we could get the best bang for our buck.
They're everywhere. Just watch out for poison oak.
Oh.
I tested probably about 10 different species of acorns in Southern California. I would say the clear winner was the California Black Oak.
How bitter are they? I mean, I'm not going to bite into it right now, but like how bad are they?
Good. You can try it right now if you want. You want to try one?
Okay.
There you go. Can you okay. give that a taste? Just a little bit.
It's not that bad. It's not that bad. I've had like, you know, those almonds that have been in storage in forever and they have that tangy taste. Mm-hmm. This is almost similar, but a little bit more tangier.
Jess says that I could only have one small bite though, because there's some toxic chemicals in there that need to be leached out.
Can you give me a story and like, how'd you get into all this?
My first time I found an oyster mushroom and knew for certain what it was. I knew that if I ate it, I wasn't gonna die. I remember going to bed that night thinking that could be it. That could be the end. But here I am, many, many, many mushrooms later. I feel like it's been a lifelong process. As a kid, I loved nature, fascinated with plants and animals. I was outside as much as I possibly could be. Kind of got sidetracked for a while. I had to, you know, go to school and get a real job. But after my first daughter was born, I was pulled back to nature through wanting to eat cleaner, wanting to keep diving deeper into where my food was coming from. Chefs started to find out about me and wanted to collaborate and work together. Foraging for chefs was hard work. Every single week, out and about, trying as hard as I could to collect the amounts that they wanted while also balancing the sustainability aspect. And like, I don't want to, you know, have a bad impact on these places. It was cool. I got to work with some really high-end chefs that I absolutely respect, but it was started eating at my conscience quite a bit. Like, it's not sustainable to feed massive amounts of people who aren't doing the work themselves.
After the pandemic, Jess decided to stop selling forage goodies to restaurants. Instead, she started teaching.
That's where change happens, you know, helping people understand where food comes from, seeing value in what's around us. There's kind of this aha moment of like, whoa, I just saw where that grows and I saw how to collect it and how to prepare it. And we're eating it and it's all comes full circle. You know, forager's mindset, the abundance is everywhere. So this is the acorn tortilla. I'm going to cook up the nettle first.
Oh, fuck. Oh, I feel it now.
Now you're feeling it.
Aye! Damn! And this is what you do when you cook this, girl?
You can use gloves if you want, but don't have gloves at the moment, so.
Am I gonna bleed?
No.
Ow, 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 ow.
Don't worry, though. They don't sting once they're ready to eat.
Mmm. This is pretty good. I was expecting it to be, like, not soft. Mm. But it's melty. The nettle, I mean, it tastes like a green, but not like a weird, like, what it looks like in the wild, you know? This is my first time getting gathered food in the wild and then coming back and having a meal. I've not eaten from an oak tree before, and I definitely have not had a, como se llama? Acorn tortilla. That's delicious, by the way. You know, it was funny because I was telling my friends, I'm like, oh, we're going to go find food. It sounds kind of like, you know, out there, right? And then my friend's like, no, I forage my food, Brian. You see me do it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I just connect the pieces, right? Connect the dots. And I think it's a beautiful way to connect with nature, but it's also a beautiful way to understand a little bit more of yourself. Like, just understanding that the acid from this plant, it stings a little, but in the end, you have a nutritious meal, right? So it's like not being afraid to dare and live a little and do something different.
Alrighty, y'all. That's it for today. The park ranger's coming along, so we gotta pack up all this food and bounce. I'll catch y'all later.
Hey, thanks for listening to the weekend edition of the LA Report. We'll be back tomorrow with more of what's happening around LA. Until then, enjoy your weekend. Try to take it easy. I'm Julia Paskin.
This program is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.